The audible of the best in Bitcoin. This is the Cryptoconomy. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. A huge thank you and much love to all our subscribers of the Cryptoconomy podcast, soon to be Bitcoin Audible, and as well to the awesome crew over at Swan Bitcoin, allowing me to stack sats while I'm sitting here doing something totally unrelated. That's right, my Bitcoin savings plan is stacking sats every week, and I don't have to think about it. If you guys have not seen it, you got to check out the video that a few of us Raleigh Bitcoiners put together about living on Bitcoin in 2020. Just went live a couple days ago on YouTube. And it's been getting a lot of good feedback, which I'm very happy about because it took me forever to put together. But I think you guys will enjoy it. So I put the link in the show notes so you can check that out. And you can probably also find it on my Twitter feed. But let's get back into today's read. We're going to get back into Giacomo's awesome piece on privacy that we started last week. This will be part two on the treatise of Bitcoin and privacy. Don't be misled by red herrings. This is another one from the essential publication at bitcoinmagazine.com. They're the best in the space. Without further ado, though, let's go ahead and dive right in. A treatise on Bitcoin and privacy, part two. Don't be misled by red herrings. By Giacomo Zucco. March 20th, 2020. In part one of this treatise, we examined the fundamental relationship between Bitcoin and privacy by going back to the beginning with the white paper. In spite of some excellent privacy-preserving options that have been available to users since those early days, we seem to have taken a few wrong turns. But to fix it, in order to make Bitcoin's privacy, quote, great again, we must be able to distinguish between real privacy and red herrings that can only lead us further off the path. Fiat gateways lead to privacy graveyards. Bitcoin is an effective system to transfer and store wealth, but that wealth has first to enter the system somehow, very often coming from fiat money. Of course, you can also earn Satoshis directly in exchange for goods and services you provide instead of buying them with fiat. Fiat-enabled Bitcoin on-ramps, often known as cryptocurrency exchanges, acting as liquidity bridges, created huge privacy problems in Bitcoin. In order to manage fiat, exchanges will have to use traditional bank accounts. In order to get those, they have to meekly accept all the rules, conditions, and limitations banks require. Traditional fiat banks, in turn, will pass over the extremely complex and heavy compliance burden they received from governments and regulatory agencies, including that concentration of economic illiteracy called KYC AML regulation. So fiat to Bitcoin bridges will almost always end up demanding a scary amount of personal information from their user, linking that information to a few deposit and withdrawal addresses, often incentivizing continuous reuse, and then even hiring chain analysis companies in order to follow, trace, tail, and stalk all the previous and following economic activity on-chain. Why chain analysis? The first and most important reason for doing so is because these on-ramps are scared to lose the privilege of having a fiat bank account. Bitcoin was, is, and will always be considered a borderline reality by governments and government-sanctioned legal cartels, like modern fiat banks. Thus, it's realistic to assume they would close down operative accounts to any exchange which couldn't guarantee the same level of financial surveillance that fiat banks routinely enact. For this reason, fiat-enabled gateways not only keep promoting wrong and dangerous uses of the Bitcoin protocol, discouraging security best practices and hiring chain analysis spy companies, they often even go to great lengths to publicly praise KYC AML nonsense regulations and to push the narrative that Bitcoin is completely traceable, marketing some probabilistic assumptions as legal proofs and ignoring even the existence of the fundamental privacy features of the protocol. For a while now, these businesses have been freezing or confiscating users' accounts because of what theoretical chain analysis heuristics, dishonestly promoted as facts, suggest these users may have been doing way before or way after their interaction with the exchange, basically trying to break fungibility in Bitcoin. We often see this happening for activities that aren't even explicitly considered illegal in the specific jurisdiction under which they happened. Online gambling, adult services, political campaigns, etc. Anything considered even remotely controversial has been depicted as forbidden, and any statistical guess about on-chain activity, based on common patterns and typical tools, has been depicted as proven. Of course, there's nothing really proven in chain analysis heuristics, so the spy companies arbitrarily decide how many on-chain hops to look for, arbitrarily assuming who is doing what. Even assuming that such heuristics are correct, they have never been 100% reliable, and they are less and less so each day, while Bitcoin developers build better tools and Bitcoin users start employing best practices. This behavior is unacceptable. It is the digital equivalent of your physical bank sending private investigators to follow your every move for days after you withdraw cash at the ATM, and then freezing or confiscating your bank account entirely if that PI comes back with a report that says you may have, with some probability, engaged in controversial actions with that cash. More recently, this shady behavior has extended beyond some generically controversial activities engaged by, quote, somebody somehow connected with customers, to encompass even the very act of trying to use Bitcoin's security and privacy best practices. Closing the blinds. In January 2020, a company that operates a regulated exchange froze a customer's account once they discovered possible hints that somebody, possibly the customer himself, but after some hops following the withdrawal transaction, that is, not even directly, was using a wallet enabling privacy best practices. Again, imagine your physical bank sending a private investigator to follow your steps for days after you withdraw some cash at the ATM, and then freezing or confiscating your bank account if that private investigator reports that says you may have, with some probability, closed your shutters at home, or pulled your shower curtains while naked, or put a lock on your personal journal, or used HTTPS within your web browser. Furthermore, the specific message to the customer was tragically hilarious. It said that the business, quote, can't condone activities such as peer-to-peer mixing or gambling, end quote. All this while talking about Bitcoin, which is literally a peer-to-peer protocol whose transactions can natively work as mixers, and coming from a business that operates in cryptocurrency trading, which some consider not that different from gambling. Don't fall for red herrings. There have been many reactions from Bitcoin users and analysts to these dodgy examples of behavior, many of which are based on logical fallacies or straight-on distortion of the facts. A classical example is the absurd notion that Bitcoin users should not use privacy best practices because that's dangerous. Red herring number one: being private will get you into trouble. The pseudo-argument goes something like this. Since some overzealous business may use unreliable heuristics to accuse you of adopting privacy and security best practices that they have arbitrarily defined as unacceptable, possibly freezing or even confiscating your account, or flagging it as suspicious, you should just stop using those security best practices and move to insecure alternatives instead. In other words, to use our physical bank example, since your bank might flag your account if the PI they sent after you comes back with a report that says that you may have, with some probability, used privacy best practices a few days after a cash withdrawal, you should just stop closing your shutters while home, or pulling the shower curtain while naked, or putting a lock on your personal journal, or using HTTPS within your web browser. This is nonsense, of course. If anything, it's not using privacy and security best practices that would turn out to be extremely dangerous, not just for your financial safety, but also for your physical safety. Reminder, Bitcoin's privacy is all or nothing. Once a business is able to attach your physical identities, not just to an on-chain address, but also to all the future and past history connected with it, all it takes is a little leak. By the business itself, by its spy contractors, or by one of the countless government agencies which will receive and pass along that information to direct very dangerous enemies to your doorstep. Incidentally, the pseudo-argument is flawed more fundamentally as well. Even if you were so reckless as to decide to trust this third party with a complete account of your future and past transactions, in spite of the risk to your personal security and that of your loved ones, you may achieve the very same result just by sending it the cryptographic proofs of all the inputs you ever signed, either on-chain or on upper layers, allowing the meddling gateway to read through each of your CoinJoin or Lightning Network routing, all without giving up generic privacy best practices. You are still risking a leak, but at least you're not giving every random guy with an internet connection an easy way to de-anonymize and stalk you and others you interact with. Red herring number two. If you're just using Bitcoin to invest, you don't need to worry about privacy. Usually this red herring comes with some distorted vision of Bitcoin's utility. If users just want to invest in Bitcoin as an uncorrelated financial asset with some disinflationary features, they say, then they don't need privacy at all. This pseudo-argument is severely flawed. Here's the bad news. Gold was, for many, many centuries up until 1933, a typically uncorrelated financial asset with some disinflationary features that people in the United States and elsewhere could invest in. But then came Executive Order 6102. Gold was confiscated all across the nation, and all the investors who didn't protect their privacy, which was especially hard with paper gold kept in custody by trusted third parties eager to comply with the order, but also pretty hard with actual physical gold, difficult to hide in large amounts or to smuggle across a border, had to give it to the government. A good general heuristic is this. If you are a privileged first world investor with a good KYC identity and you are looking for some kind of investment that is politically uncontroversial now and likely to remain that way, then you will soon be able to access that type of financial product from your favorite fiat bank. If that describes you, don't even concern yourself with complex stuff like private keys, blockchain fees, addresses. Leave the real protocol to real users. Just call your good old bank over the phone and ask to buy some, quote, Bitcoin-flavored risk, certificates, futures, ETNs, ETFs, CFDs, etc. If, on the other hand, you are not as privileged, like the majority of the world population today which does not have a KYC-friendly identity, or if you think that the financial asset you seek is a bit controversial today, already or likely to become so in the future, then you will eventually need some very strong privacy techniques to acquire it and to safely store it, since, quote, legally compliant exchanges, brokers, and marketplaces will do everything they can to keep you out of it or take it from you. Red herring number three. Just use a magical privacy coin. A second typical reaction, even more absurd, is to suggest privacy altcoins as a solution to this problem. A regulated exchange will flag your account if you use best practices such as CoinJoin or Lightning Network or address reuse avoidance. Then, instead of Bitcoin, just use some illiquid Bitcoin clone whose design has been altered in such a way that it's said to offer more fungibility, right? The superficial problem with this approach is that such magic privacy coins don't actually exist in the real world. On one hand, that's because most of the changes marketed as privacy improvements are either entirely fake or greatly exaggerated. They also tend to come with serious trade-offs, which make these clones otherwise unusable at scale over the long run, usually including a completely centralized development process trivial to compromise. On the other hand, even if such a coin were to exist from a technological point of view, it couldn't work in practice from an economical point of view. Remember, privacy loves company. A huge chunk of the Bitcoin economy and its users would have to move to the very same Bitcoin clone as you. Otherwise, your transactions will have a lower liquidity and a smaller anonymity set, regardless of how perfect and sci-fi worthy the privacy tech you are using is. More on these magical privacy coins and why they are useless. The Bitcoin plus privacy coin combo fallacy. There are variants of this red herring which are based on some kind of bimetallic standard idea. Those proponents will suggest that you use Bitcoin as your fundamental store of value, which centralized illiquid clones can't be for obvious economic reasons, and then add a particular privacy altcoin for privacy and transactions. Of course, that can't work in most real-world scenarios. Assuming that the payer and the payee both use Bitcoin as a long-term store of value, the payee would have to move Satoshis from his personal storage solution to some kind of market, regulated or not, doesn't really matter here, with the same privacy issues as any other Bitcoin transaction, then exchange those Satoshis for altcoins on some low-liquidity shared order book with very low privacy, and then move the altcoins over their native system with a low anonymity set to an address provided by the payee. Then the payee would have to repeat the same steps in reverse. The privacy guarantees of the whole process would be, overall, way lower than a normal Bitcoin transaction performed following the best practices. Of course, these guarantees can be increased if either the payee or the payer batch many transactions in one big altcoin reserve, exchanging Satoshis only once, way before or way after the single individual transactions. But this would require the altcoin to be a reliable store of value for long periods of time, which illiquid and centralized Bitcoin clones, often crippled by unbalanced trade-off choices between privacy features and other very delicate aspects, can't be. The deeper problem with this approach is that even if feasible, it would become completely useless pretty quickly. The very same reasons that convinced some regulated exchanges to actively discourage or even prevent their customers from adopting privacy best practices on Bitcoin would readily convince the very same exchanges to just delist any privacy-focused Bitcoin clone. The smaller the altcoin, the weaker the incentive to list it. The bigger the altcoin, the stronger the regulatory pressure to delist it. It's as simple as that. The mandatory privacy versus opt-in privacy fallacy. Some weak attempts at steelmaning this approach focus on the distinction between mandatory privacy and opt-in privacy. With Bitcoin, the altcoin proponents say, you are not forced to use the fungibility features at the protocol level, so it's easy for the exchange to ask you not to use them. But with my altcoin, you have no choice, so the regulated exchange will also have no choice but allow you to use them. Again, this is nonsense. It's not true that a privacy feature can ever be, quote, mandatory at the protocol level. As the history of Bitcoin teaches us, it's mostly about tools. Even when the base protocol includes strong fungibility capabilities, if the most widespread tools don't leverage them, then people will simply not use them. They'll just resort to using whatever is easy and available, even if that means adopting bad practices instead. It doesn't matter which protocol you use. If the tools are inadequate, so is your privacy. Just as you can have a Bitcoin wallet that is incompatible with CoinJoin and that forces address reuse, you can also have a Monero wallet that leaks confidential information about amounts and always constructs ring signatures between every single user and himself. If such a wallet is widespread, spy companies can assume such behavior as common and build de-anonymizing heuristics. Of course, altcoin proponents may just build and market tools that actually use the privacy features already present in their clone at the protocol level. But then again, they would need just as much time, money, and effort that is required for building and marketing tools that actually use the privacy features already present in Bitcoin at the protocol level. What really matters? Incentives. A more useful distinction to examine is the one between privacy features that are economically convenient to use and privacy features that are costly to use. The perfect bad example would be that of shielded transactions in the altcoin Zcash. Since they take way more space inside blocks and way more computation time to be verified and signed, making this last action almost impossible on a light client, economic incentives push the already few users of the coin to unshielded transactions, which are just an outdated version of the traditional Bitcoin ones. As a direct effect, many users will think they have more privacy when this process, in fact, makes tracking and de-anonymizing far easier. An indirect effect will be that the very few users who do decide to pay the extra costs for shielded transactions will find themselves within an even smaller anonymity set, ending up exposed instead of protected. An opposite example would be the Lightning Network on Bitcoin. Since block space is expensive, users often have strong economic incentives to switch to payment channels to save fees, reducing the time chain footprint to just opening and closing channels. Same old story. Ultimately, it's not surprising at all that some of the most vocal proponents of the coin join is risky because your account will get flagged narrative turn out to be also promoters of new illiquid privacy altcoins, which they hope to push to profit from pump and dump schemes. Same old story. Bitcoin fees are too high. Buy my low fee altcoin. Or Bitcoin signatures aren't quantum proof. Buy my quantum ready altcoin. Or Bitcoin's smart contracts aren't flexible enough. Buy my Turing complete altcoin. Or Bitcoin is not fungible enough. Buy my privacy altcoin. Solutions are coming. Are there real solutions and ways to mitigate the threat that regulated exchanges pose to the privacy and security for Bitcoin users beyond the red herrings? Yes, many. The ultimate solution, albeit very slow, will eventually come from the evolution of the market. While more and more resources will leave the fiat world to enter Bitcoin over the years, more and more parts of the Bitcoin economy will move away from fiat gateways to Satoshi-denominated trades among users. Gateways will still be important, but gradually less so, making their bargaining power lower and lower over time. Fiercer competition will also help. People will be happy to leave meddling private investigator hiring banks who force them to keep shower curtains open if they have alternatives. More tools. Another mitigation will come from the evolution of Bitcoin tools. While more and more modern wallets will make it harder to reuse addresses or merge inputs, and easier to coordinate coin join rounds, regulated exchanges will have a harder time forcing their customers to use only old, outdated, or inferior wallets instead. Lightning Network. Yet another mitigation will come from the adoption of the Lightning Network. Since block space in the base layer will become more expensive, users will be strongly incentivized to route transactions over payment channels instead. It will be harder for regulated exchanges to arbitrarily ban customers due to a probabilistic link between the Satoshis they deposited or withdrew on the Lightning Network, especially when the latter will be ubiquitous, thanks to economic incentives. Protocol upgrades. Additional improvements may possibly come from the next protocol upgrades in Bitcoin, especially the one called cross-input Schnorr signature aggregation. This upgrade will make coordinating with several different parties within CoinJoin rounds extremely convenient from an economical perspective. Decentralized exchanges. Another hope comes from the idea of decentralized exchanges, or DEXs. So far, they suffer from liquidity limitations and their security remains tricky. While the Bitcoin leg of any trade can be easily trust minimized, the fiat leg remains ultimately trust-based, making complex and expensive escrow mechanisms necessary. In turn, escrow mechanisms tend to prove very difficult to decentralize effectively. Your privacy is in your hands. Just keep calm and be diligent. Don't submit to dangerous privacy violations. Don't reuse addresses. Use CoinJoin. Close your shutters when you're at home. Pull the shower curtains when you're naked. Put a lock on your personal journal, and use HTTPS when surfing the web. In the end, Bitcoin fixes this. This is an op-ed contribution by Giacomo Zucco. Views expressed are his own and do not necessarily reflect those of Bitcoin Magazine or BTC Incorporated. So, what if I told you that there is a secret Bitcoin trading strategy that historically has been enormously successful, takes almost no effort, and is guaranteed that you will not miss out on the Bitcoin revolution? It's called Auto-DCA, or dollar cost averaging, and you're going to find the easiest, simplest solution to that at swanbitcoin.com. It's a brilliant, super advanced strategy of just buying the hardest money in the world automatically all of the time and not caring what the price is. Amazing. Truly revolutionary. You set an auto purchase every week, every month, every paycheck, whatever interval you want, and you stack those precious, perfectly scarce, decentralized sats. The easiest place to do that is Swan Bitcoin. In fact, there are hardly any other options to Swan Bitcoin, even despite the fact that they are the best option by far. And thanks to Swan Bitcoin, you will not miss out on being a part of the future. And you won't have to worry about having waited until it dipped just a little bit more before finally buying. Set it once with Swan Bitcoin, and you're done. So check out swanbitcoin.com and start your Bitcoin savings plan like me. You know, come to think of it, I'm not sure when exactly they actually buy Bitcoin, so it might have actually been today. I'm not sure. I think I bought Bitcoin today, which it dipped, so hey, I bought the dip. But I don't know, because it's just running in the background. It's just buying Bitcoin for me all the time now. It's pretty great. Don't have to think about it. This article, both of these articles, this is, again, part two of the continuing from the one we did last week. I'll be sure to put the link in the show notes so you can hit the first article. You can listen to it if you haven't yet. But they were both just excellent articles. Another thank you to Bitcoin Magazine, by the way, for this, and Giacomo Zucco, obviously, for putting this together. And you know, there are a lot of, it's amazing how simplistic a lot of the, well, you know, red herrings, a lot of the pseudo arguments there are around privacy, because there is almost always is a trade-off. I have not seen anything that is close to a reliable, surefire solution. You're just trading one problem for another problem, or one cost for another cost. And I feel like Giacomo does a really good job of basically laying out the general idea. The big one is the whole, the one I felt was probably the most, I don't know, viable, I guess, like alternative would be the idea of, for your private transactions, use a privacy altcoin. For your, you know, your sound money, use Bitcoin. But he's right, really, that you end up putting yourself at way more risk, and you have such a huge, just use cost. While the key part is you're lowering your anonymity set pretty substantially, and you're immediately having to find some sort of, you know, whether or not you get some decentralized exchange, which is going to give you horrible spreads, which means it's going to cost you like a 10% fee just to go back and forth twice between the two currencies. And, who knows how low your anonymity set is with some of these coins. Zcash being the example is that, like, people think that Zcash is private, and it's not at all. Nobody even uses shielded transactions. It's like a tiny, tiny subset of the overall thing, and you have to go through an exchange to get those privacy coins far more often than not. Or you go through one of these coin swap websites that, you know, track your information just as well, record your IP address and where you're coming from. Like, it's a headache. It's like, none of this is easy, and particularly considering that the I feel like the threats of these chain analysis companies and the propositions, the idea that they know what everybody owns, and I think they're way over exaggerating their actual capacity. They're selling themselves, essentially. It's very important that they look extremely effective. And, you know, it might actually be better for privacy that it hold up the appearance that they're really effective, even though they're not, and the key thing that Giacomo kept using is that, that I think is just spot on with the reality of all of these heuristics, is that in all these situations, they're basically assessing that you may have done. Like, there is a probability that you were involved in this based on how close it is to your transaction. But they don't even know if you're withdrawing to your own wallet. Like, so you could withdraw to a Wasabi wallet and you could do it as a transaction to somebody else. Just keep money on the exchange until you withdraw it to somebody else. And they ask you to withdraw to a CoinJoin transaction, to a Wasabi wallet address. They don't have a clue. It's all guesses. There is no identity information on the Bitcoin chain. Unless you explicitly say, this is my address, they don't really know. And they're basically policing on this ridiculously unreliable guess, one that will become increasingly less reliable with time for numerous different reasons. And I love that the Bitcoin community really is pushing this, and you're finding it much more on Twitter as well, that Samurai Wallet and Wasabi Wallet, these things are getting faster and easier to use. And they're still more costly. This is the big thing that, because there's multiple rounds usually of the privacy mechanisms and the CoinJoin in general. That's where I think he talks about, like, towards the end, is that this is about incentives. Like, that's really the key thing. And that's where I think future improvements to the protocol and future tools are going to be absolutely key. As the bad example with shielded transactions, they are much, much bigger and take tons of computation. And even with like something like Liquid Network, the sidechain, like, you have confidential transactions, but we're not going to get to confidential transactions on the base layer for the same reason. It's, you know, it's a much larger transaction, takes way more computation to verify. And it would basically, the burden of verifying the Bitcoin chain would increase substantially if people started using that, or if that you started actually see that on the base layer. Not to mention that it would be more costly anyway, just in fees. So again, like, your economic incentives don't align with your privacy incentives. And that's always been kind of an issue, that greater privacy has always come with a major cost. So unless you cared heavily about privacy, you didn't get it. It just wasn't convenient enough, and, you know, most people just aren't going to go out of their way to secure something that they don't even quite understand why they should value in the first place. And it is clearly the case that the vast majority of people are like, oh, well, if I got nothing to hide, I gotta be private. And often the lesson of security is never learned until you pay the enormous cost of not having it. But this is where Bitcoin is actually in a very interesting position, particularly in its development history and what we could see moving forward. And how Bitcoin's use could lead to better privacy in the future, and most importantly, how that better privacy could come at a cost savings rather than a cost increase. Aligning the privacy option as the cheaper option. And that's where I really think the game is going to change. And one thing that I think is actually an incredibly important factor in this, that, which is funny because it's not meant this way at all. It's for a completely different reason, but that the Bitcoin block size is kept small. What that leads to is the fact that you can only put so much data on the actual chain, and the less data you have to put on it to secure ownership, the less data there is to actually analyze and connect to any one person. You know, there's a unpopular opinion that, you know, the most of the people would probably disagree with or not kind of see that this might be a reality in the future, but that I think having a single address as a single owner, Like, to have one UTXO on the Bitcoin system will become an incredibly rare thing in the not too distant future. I think shared ownership models and channel style models like the Lightning Network and building out contractual networks on top of this thing where each UTXO is a combination of ownerships and you know, contracts for sharing and doing activity off the chain. And of course, UTXOs that are aggregates of many different transactions and many different owners. I think that will become the norm in the not too distant future. And, you know, 5 to 10 years, that's what most of the base layer will look like. And in doing so, all of these chain heuristics and the analysis that they think is only half reliable today will be completely unreliable. And, you know, Lightning Network is such a good example of kind of like a micro step in that direction. Actually, a pretty big step, but kind of a micro version of the broader picture is that your payments, you own a channel. You know, your payments are off the network or are off the chain. And in doing so, only when you settle, settlement transactions are the only things that are seen, that are visible on the base layer. And all the payments are private by default. And then the significant decrease in cost, Lightning Network is the more private option. And yet, Lightning Network is the cheaper way to maintain a spending wallet on the Bitcoin network. And that's basically what we just did with, I was talking about the video at the beginning of this episode. We did a whole day, and I think all we ever did was spend Lightning. I didn't put everything that we did in the video just because it was too much stuff. But we ran around town, and if I'm not mistaken, we used Breeze, Fold, and BitRefill for everything that we did the whole day. And, you know, made a little video out of it, and it worked. And, you know, what does that take? One, maybe two Bitcoin transactions, I think. Maybe I think he had to refill it or something at some point during the day because he emptied his wallet. But that's basically it. Like the Lightning Network was the faster, cheaper, and more private option. And the fact that those are aligned in the network and that you can no longer do chain analysis, but that you have to figure out some way to have some huge position on the Lightning Network to attempt to do do network analysis on the Lightning Network, and that's even less reliable, like these things that we've talked about before. In fact, I think it was a Bitcoin Magazine article about the paying yourself and paying in a loop on the Lightning Network. So, you know, you're sending out $100, you leave $20 at some place, at some hop somewhere else in the network, because that's your actual payment, and you send the $80 back around to yourself in a different channel. And in doing so, all of the network analysis is broken. Nobody can see, even if somebody was on both sides of that transaction, they would not know where or how that payment was made. And these things are so much easier to put together in something like the Lightning Network. And the movement and development of these sorts of tools happened faster on the Lightning Network. And then combine that with something like the cross-input, the Schnorr signature aggregation, and something he didn't even mention, that is also an element of Schnorr signatures, which we've got the BIP for, and you know, maybe a year, less than 2 years out now. But that also enables Taproot, which makes it so that your Lightning channels, like essentially any script and like set of scripts that you can do in like a tree within a single transaction, it all is just hidden behind a single public key. It's all hidden behind a single signature. So the script is actually hidden behind the hash. In other words, every transaction looks identical regardless of like what scripts it uses, and regardless of whether there are 10 people signing it or one person signing it. Every transaction that uses Taproot only ever looks like a single public key. Even though it could be a 9 of 10 multisig, it could be a 3 of 5 multisig, it could be a channel opening and splice combined into a single set of outputs. It could be owned by, it could be a transaction aggregated from two or three different people all at once. This will completely destroy the typical like chain heuristics and analysis that goes on, because you won't even be able to, it will actually lose. It's kind of crazy to think about that. You won't really be able to look at the Lightning Network anymore. Like, if people have private channels on the Lightning Network, like right now, you can actually estimate them. You can actually look at the multi-signature transactions. What are they called? It's like a pay-to-script hash or something like that. There's like one specific type of transaction. But anyway, you can look at the channel being made. It's a, you know, two of two multi-sig. It has scripts. You can distinguish on the chain that, okay, well, this looks like a Lightning channel being opened. And you can compare that to what you publicly get from the gossip network on the Lightning Network. And you can see it's like, oh, well, crap. So Lightning says that there are, you know, 5,000 channels here, but I'm seeing 2,000 additional channels on the chain that have been opened and have not been closed. They've not been spent. They're open UTXOs, which means we have about 2,000 private channels. Well, that's going to go away. And the development, or excuse me, not the development, but the adoption of something like Taproot when Schnorr and stuff is available is probably going to be really, really fast, because it makes all of it cheaper. You know, one public key for a channel that before required multiple public keys and multiple scripts to knock that down back to a normal transaction is a huge cost savings. Wallets, services, exchanges, users, everybody upgrading to that is not going to take very long. Again, those economic incentives are aligned with the better privacy option. And I think we'll continue to see that. There's so many other privacy technologies that I think have this same sort of balance. And increasingly, if you look at just start look at Taproot by itself, look at Lightning by itself, look at aggregation by itself, look at CoinJoin by itself, look at the cross-input signature aggregation, which essentially does the Taproot trick, except instead of for multiple scripts, it does it for all the signatures for many different inputs and many different outputs, and it will make a CoinJoin transaction cheaper than a regular transaction from 100 inputs to 100 outputs. If you do a cross-input Schnorr aggregation, like signature aggregation, you'll have one signature on that. Now, we're still a little bit further away from that. That's not even in active development right now. They're basically developing the building blocks that will lead to that being possible after this next set of soft forks that we'll go through probably. But again, you look at any of these things by themselves, and they're pretty powerful tools. But what are they all together? Alex Bosworth just tweeted out about how you could do a payment by doing an atomic swap into Lightning to a Lightning payment that paid to another submarine swap out of Lightning, and then paying like a Bitcoin invoice, and you've completely broken any chain analysis from your coins to the coins that got spent at the other end. And you did it all atomically, meaning that you didn't have to trust anybody. Each stage in the transaction was dependent on the previous stage actually happening. Put all of that together, what do you get? That's an incredible amount of privacy. And almost every one of those that I mentioned is also a cost savings. So if these technologies get adopted, if we start using these tools, if we start figuring out where we can apply them and we make good user experience with these things, well, they'll get used and grant that our anonymity sets will get greater and chain analysis will get increasingly worthless, while people who don't even necessarily care about privacy will end up using them. But in the end, I think the lesson of this is that the fact that exchanges are being wary and trying to police on-chain privacy, I think the solution to that is for everyone to use it. I think the first red herring is that, you know, being private will get you into trouble. I think that's a terrible, terrible, stupid thing to start pushing, and unbelievably dangerous to set as a standard. And I think we should go the exact opposite way. I think we should stop using exchanges. We don't need to. Why? You're going to, the hilarity of saying that, like, they don't support gambling and they're a shitcoin exchange. That's, I almost laughed while I was reading it. But I think we should increasingly use, these should be the security and privacy best practices. And particularly as they become the more economic option, we should push them as hard as we can, and we should stop using exchanges that are spying on us for days after or before we use their service. Because you know what? It's none of their business. It's absolutely none of their business. And they should not be able to see into my wallet, my history, and all the coins that I have, and all the other transactions with all the other services that I do, just because I use their service this one time on this one day. That is such a dangerous precedent to set, that they could get away with that, or that that is in any way acceptable. Don't become complacent on this issue, because that's what we did already. That's kind of what how we found ourselves here, is that we did kind of become complacent, and we thought Bitcoin was more private than it was without us having to do anything. And, you know, it's not. It does have trade-offs all over the place, despite the fact that it's synonymous and does have a lot of added privacy. There are always, you know, that fiat to Bitcoin gateway is always the largest attack vector. It's a highly, highly trusted environment, so they're going to take every piece of data they can from you to know who they're working with. And that's because of the incredible risk of, and how terrible and costly the fiat side of all of this is, and of course the risk that they will lose their fiat bank account. So, you know, we've got a lot of work to do, but I think it is being fixed, and I think it is solvable. And I think the idea that Bitcoin is not private is simply not the case. There are numerous options, and it is increasing all the time. And I still think that Lightning Network itself will be seen more as a boon for privacy, even more so than it was for scaling. I've thought for quite some time that the kind of Trojan horse, the thing that people are really, really not considering, is just how powerful that network could be for privacy in payments and privacy in ownership moving forward, and the movement in and out of that network, just like that incredibly simple and fascinating example that Alex Bosworth shared today. But I need to get back to it. I got a lot of other stuff to do. I'm still working on some other audio. And we will close this episode out for today. Another huge thank you to Bitcoin Magazine and Giacomo Zucco, as always, for amazing work. There's just always something awesome to read up here, and I have been relying on them for such a long time for content. It's hard to believe how long they've been around. So definitely, if you're not a Bitcoin Magazine fanatic like me, you are failing. And thank you to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network also for supporting and spreading this show out to as many people as possible, so that everybody can get the audible of the Bitcoin space. This is the Crypto Economy. I love you all. Thank you. Do not forget to subscribe to the show. That is the Crypto Economy, but soon to be Bitcoin Audible. So everybody keep an eye out for that. Don't forget to check out the video that JC and a couple of the other guys at the Raleigh Bitcoin Meetup put together for y'all. We've been getting a lot of good feedback, so I think you guys will enjoy it. It was fun. And lastly, don't forget to start your Bitcoin savings plan. I do that over at swanbitcoin.com. I'll have the link in the show notes for that as well. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, take it easy, guys.